Hello and welcome to volume 138 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll hear about a comprehensive report on the state of Alabama's forest. We'll learn more about how your forest can store carbon. We'll talk with someone who is very familiar with the hardwood markets, and we'll talk to an attorney who can discuss the solutions to lack of access. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is David Steele, an attorney who also has a degree in forestry. We wanted to talk with him about one of the most common problems associated with forest land, and that's the lack of access. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Hayes. Appreciate it so much.
David, you often hear of a landowner who has used a road for years only to be blocked out from using it by the person who owns the land where the road is located. What right does the person have who's been using a road that everyone's used for years?
Well, the threshold question is whether or not there's either a specific conveyance of a right-of-way / easement, or whether there has been a reservation for the use of the road in previous deeds or other instruments that relate to the road in question. You know, in the absence of that, it is very difficult for a landowner to prove that he has a, quote, legal right to use a particular road. The assumption is that use of these type roads have been largely by permission and not necessarily because the person had a legal right. You can understand the dilemma that this causes for landowners who are getting along with one another. No one wants to suggest that he cannot be neighborly and allow his adjacent landowners to go through his property. At the same time, if you simply have this gentleman's agreement and don't have it reduced to writing, and then there's a change in ownership or sometimes just a change in attitude among the existing owners, the issue quickly manifests itself in a way that you're not able to enforce the right to use the road. So threshold advice for landowners that are quote unquote getting along with their neighbors: talk to them, go ahead now while everybody is on good terms, and get some written agreement about the use of the road. That can really save a lot of headache and cost in the future by getting that done. If you already are past that point and there's conflict and somebody blocks the road, be prepared to go back and to the best of your ability, prove with great detail of the fact that while, yes, you wanted to get along and be accommodating, that you always took the position that you had the legal right to use that road. And on those rare occasions where someone may have objected to your use, you went anyway. You continued to go through, you unlocked gates, whatever it took, and possibly that would be strong enough factual basis that you could prevail on your claim to use the road.
That sounds kind of like not being neighborly and not asking permission if that's the route that you have to go.
That's exactly right, and that's unfortunate because it goes against the idea that a lot of, if we can, country people have toward getting along with their neighbor. Mm-hmm. You are absolutely correct.
Generally speaking, is there a right of access to landlocked property? And if so, what route could a landowner expect to receive?
Right. There is a right to access your property. And there are a couple of different mechanisms. One is through the circuit court. One is through the probate court. You may, if you don't otherwise have access, you may have to pay for that access. And it is not necessarily over the most convenient right of way. It may simply be that you've got a right to get out to a public road, but a court-appointed group of, and I think they're termed commissioners, can go out and make a determination where that roadway can go, taking into account the relative needs and circumstances of all the affected landowners, and they would actually assess, based upon their evaluation, an amount of money to be paid for that access. But it does not necessarily mean that you're going to get to use the road that everybody's used for the last 50 years. There may be another route that is less intrusive to other landowners that you may be required to use.
So that's the probate court. You mentioned also the circuit court.
Well, in the circuit court proceeding, you would generally be trying to make a claim that you did have some type of legal right arising either out of previous documents that may have referred generally to access but did not convey a specific right-of-way, or that you had some type of essentially claim of adverse possession or right to use because of a pattern of conduct. But again, it is so difficult to meet that standard because in most cases, your factual basis is going to be, it's just that everybody's always used the road and everybody's been okay with it up until now. And that sort of a statement, sad as it may be, is not enough to succeed in a claim to use an existing road.
And in that case, there's no duty to pay. It's already been taken or acquired in some way.
That's
the difference between the two. But actually, is it easier to prove the circuit court one where you don't pay or the probate court one where you do pay?
The probate court, your more likely success is going to be in probate court, even though you're probably going to have to pay some money to get that, as opposed to using a road that may be generally already in place and being somewhat maintained.
Okay. Well, good advice, David. Thank you for that. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Each year, the Alabama Forestry Commission publishes a report which describes the current state of the forests, including privately owned forests, and describes the current volumes and harvest price trends. Gary Faulkner with the Alabama Forestry Commission is here. Welcome, Gary.
Good to be here, Hayes.
What do you see from the 2019 report?
Well, we'll just begin by saying, as you and our audience understand, the Alabama's forest resources are a critical component of the U.S. South and national production of wood products, as well as to Alabama's economy. It's the second largest manufacturing sector within the state. Further, the U.S. South and Alabama's forest and wood products footprint is growing in importance within the nation. We like to say any good salesman worth their salt would say without a product, there is nothing to sell. Well, fortunately here in Alabama, we have a significant product to sell. And our product, forest resources, is really becoming larger. Here are a few facts I think that we can report from our latest report. On page 4 of the report, you will see that Alabama's timberland covers 23 million acres and the third largest commercial timberland within the U.S., quite the opposite from our western states. The report also reflects that Alabama's timberland is 93.6% privately owned and only 6.4% publicly owned. The forest industry owns approximately 6.6% of Alabama's timberland, while 86.9% is owned by the non-industrial private landowner. The report also shows that Alabama's forests are comprised of 46% softwood stands, 42% hardwood stands, and 12% mixed softwood and hardwood stands. These values are only fractionally different from 2018. On page 19, you will see that there is approximately 1.3 billion tons of combined softwood and hardwood growing stock volume reported for 2019. This is up 2.2% over 2018. And amazingly, Alabama leads the nation in loblolly pine growing stock with approximately 562 million tons. Further, since the year 2000, growing stock volume has increased 29.6%, with softwood capturing the majority of this increase.
Well, with that volume number that you just mentioned, is there any danger that anyone should believe that we're cutting too much of our timber? And what is the correlation that you see between the current volumes and the prices that landowners are receiving now?
Well, Hayes, we're safe in our inventory and in no danger from depleting our total timber resources. Alabama has a very sustainable forest. although we have a large and diverse manufacturing forest industry, we are in no threat of harvesting more than our growth due to our state's positive growth-to-drain ratios. As well, many states have the same growth trend. For Alabama, our economic development team continues to recruit additional primary wood-using mills to take advantage of our tremendous surplus and provide greater markets for timber. The report also provides that other informative forest statistics relative to our harvesting. On page 49, you will be interested to know that in 2019, Alabama's harvest, as reported by severance tax, was 56% pulpwood, 40% pine sawtimber, 3% hardwood sawtimber, and 1% poles and pilings. This reflects our product demand from our forest. In terms of stumpage pricing, the truth is that an increasing supply of forest resources has a direct effect on stumpage pricing. As mentioned earlier, Alabama has seen record growth within its inventory, increasing at a greater rate than its drain. With this scenario, the stumpage prices paid to the landowner, they are difficult to anticipate while supply remains high. So if you have an overwhelming product in the market, then price may become more stabilized, possibly lower than many timberland owners may not like to see or remember from the past. Of course, local timber markets have many factors that can affect local stumpage pricing.
Okay. Well, Gary, we thank you for that. In the past, entering the carbon offset market was practical only for large landowners, but now it's more accessible to smaller landowners. Matt Smith can explain that. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
Your company has a program called Core Carbon. What is that?
Well, Core Carbon is a platform by which small forest owners can develop, optimize, and enroll their property in a carbon market program. Focused on small landowners between 40 and 5,000 acres. It was built to facilitate numerous project types, and the first one of those is going to be a forest protection or a harvest deferral project. Of course, different by design, it was built by foresters, but foresters who were listened to the other foresters and landowners about the barriers they see in other programs, and we built our Core Carbon solution to tear those barriers down. So CORE is free to landowners, simple to enroll in, payments are known up front by the landowner, and payments are secured from the beginning of the project for the first 10 years of participation.
All right, you mentioned harvest deferral program. What are the commitments or other limitations that must be made by the landowner to participate in the program?
Well, as our first project type that we'll support under the platform of CORE, the commitments are being governed by a widely accepted carbon registry, the American Carbon Registry. We're in the process of writing our methodologies and getting that through the peer review and public comment periods with the registry, but the current contract term is expected to be 40 years. So the landowner is committing for this portion of their property that they might enroll to maintain their carbon stocks on those 40 acres or 40 years, those acres for 40 years until the project commitment has been fulfilled.
Okay. What do you see as the value to the landowner? And I think people are wondering where this money is coming from.
Yeah. Well, you know, forest owners make decisions every day that influence our climate. And those that are willing to make commitments to doing things that store carbon or take in more carbon than they admit should have access to this market and realize value for what they're providing. We currently work with American Carbon Registry, as I mentioned. So the calculus is in process as we go through their review period. However, we're targeting biannual payments totaling between $10 and $20 per acre per year, secured for a 10-year term. So where's that money coming from? Well, 2020 started with unprecedented commitments from corporate America. Companies like Big Oil, Microsoft, Amazon, and the like have all made remarkable commitments and set remarkable targets for carbon neutrality. A lot of these offsets are sold through the voluntary market to these types of buyers. So lastly, before you leave me here, I do want to point out that Alabama is in a unique place in that Alabama is going to be one of the first states where Core Carbon will be launched, and I expect that to launch early in 2021. Forest owners that are interested in maintaining contact with this opportunity and getting updates can visit our website at corecarbon.com or finitecarbon.com and register for updates.
Okay. All right, Matt. Well, thank you for that. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Judd Johnson is in our markets chair. He's the editor of the Hardwood Market Report. Welcome, Judd.
Thank you, Ace. Thank you for having me.
How's the hardwood business in the U.S. now, both before and after the pandemic?
Well, it is important to know a little something about it before the pandemic. Prior to that, the industrial market group was performing extremely well and had been for the last 15 years. The grade lumber markets, which deliver the higher value to producers, has had trouble, and those troubles primarily have come with trade war with China and the tariffs that were associated with that. So this downturn in business with China that started second half of 2018 has been financially draining to the supply side of the hardwood industry. But in February of this year, China did announce temporary suspension of the tariffs on U.S. hardwoods, which provided a lot of encouragement to us and to suppliers to that marketplace. We were looking for, quite frankly, a very positive 2020. But then, of course, COVID lockdown happened. This was mid-March. State governments forced lockdown on non-essential businesses or industries. Fortunately for the forest products industry, we were deemed essential. Unfortunately, not all of our customers' businesses were deemed essential. So every market sector, we see eight market sectors in the hardwood industry. Each one of those sectors have been negatively affected by COVID, contracted business very much like an economic downturn we saw in the Great Recession. It forced dramatic reduction in sawmill production. Currently, and for the last 5 months, Eastern U.S. hardwood sawmill production has been trekking at historic low levels. In May, we saw things bottom out on sawmill production, but that was also when states began to lift the sanctions. And this is sort of giving us a light to maybe what to expect going forward with COVID. The first thing that happened in May, business did pick up a little bit, but it mostly was a transfer of inventory, began to move into the distribution stream. But as people began to go back to work, the housing industry in particular, remodeling is very strong, stimulated even greater demand. What we're also seeing from people going back to work, there's still a lot of people that are working at home. They've moved off the kitchen table. They've moved into something a little more substantial. Maybe they bought a desk. They've been looking at the same four walls for months. We've seen pent-up demand really drive some business for furniture. That's been healthy for the U.S. hardwood industry. We're looking at the housing market, and we see that it's been in deficit really since the Great Recession. So there's a very positive outlook on the housing market, and a lot of that's being driven from the high end. So when we look at those things that drive our industry, or we think that drive demand for our industry, the housing market, remodeling, those things look very positive. The economy, of course, is the big thing. We think the housing industry is going to give that a nice boost. But the economy is expected to continue to recover. U.S. hardwood lumber business, we expect to continue to recover, uneven, but recover nonetheless. Next year, the economy is expected to grow. Our outlook on China is we hope that it'll pick up where it left off in February, and we'll actually see some healthy business in China next year as well. So the outlook as we stand now, very low supply. The supply side is operating at a very low level, but strengthening demand.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jeff, for that very well done recitation on the hardwood market. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to David Steele, Gary Faulkner, Matt Smith, and Judd Johnson. There are two countries now in North America that were at one time British colonies. the governing philosophy of one is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The governing philosophy of the other is peace, order, and good governance. The United States and Canada established these as their governing philosophies about 100 years apart. Each had its own history and its own relationship with the mother country. But today we still see the tension between these two philosophies. One protects individual freedom from government. The other emphasizes the principles of good government with no emphasis on the individual. As a forest owner, where do your sentiments fall? Is it more important to have freedom as an individual, or more important to have a government that works well in order to provide the things that people in general desire? These are useful things to ponder in this election season. And on behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.